So, yesterday we explored entering the mandala and the benefits of entering the mandala. And we talked also a little bit about personal mandalas, about how you can explore what really is central to you in your life and how your life fits together. Or doesn't particularly well. And also the direction you'd like it to go in, how you'd like to see that mandala develop, how you'd like to see it change, what would be really satisfying and fulfilling to have right in the middle of it, and how the mandala of your life and your practice could look more harmonious. And we also saw yesterday how the mandala of the five Buddhas emerged from the experience of Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, how it emerged out of his enlightenment experience. And we'll explore that a bit more this morning. So today, we're going into the eastern direction. We're going to meet the Buddha Akshobhya. So I'm going to start by describing this figure of Akshobhya, the immutable, the imperturbable. That's what Akshobhya means. So in order to meet Akshobhya, we need to move on to a different level. So we need to start by just imagining vast blue sky. Just stretching away in all directions. And we tend to be very focused on form, so we think that out of the sky Akshobhya will appear. Actually, that vast open space already is Akshobhya. That's the mind of Akshobhya, completely limitless, completely free. Ungraspable awareness. And then out of the blue sky appears a deep blue figure. A figure made of deep blue light. So there's something about him which is mysterious, which is ungraspable. He appears, but you can't pin anything down. You can't grasp and say, this is the really existent Akshobhya. You can't get hold of Akshobhya. You can't actually get hold of anything, finally, in our experience. Yeah. All through life, we try to kind of cling on to things and get them and feel secure, and now at last I have it, and life just keeps slipping through our fingers, flowing through our fingers, even our fingers eventually just give way. So Akshobhya is made of light also because the experience of Akshobhya is on a level of great subtlety, of great meditative depth and absorption. So we have this Buddha who is seated cross-legged in what's called the Vajra posture in meditation, and he's adorned with silks and jewels. So to the Indian mind, he's a little bit like a prince or a king adorned with finery. So he's kind of a prince or a king of the Dharma world. And he's adorned with all the qualities of enlightenment, adorned with generosity and ethics and patience, energy, absorption, meditation, and wisdom. And with his right hand is reaching down and just touching the ground beneath him. It's not actually ground. He's seated on a lotus and a moon mat. So he's just reaching down to that with his palm turned inwards and the fingers just touching the earth. It's a very strong gesture called Bhumi Sparsha in Sanskrit, touching the earth. And with his left hand, which is just resting in his lap, upright upon it is a golden vajra, a golden diamond thunderbolt. And it's perfectly balanced on the palm of his hand. And he's surrounded by great auras of light. His body gives off light. There's an aura around his head and an aura around his body, which are said to be generated by the huge accumulations of merits and wisdom that have been produced by his practice of endless time. So we can just see this figure in our mind's eye. And that figure itself is the Dharma. Before we say anything about it, just having that figure to focus on, to feel the effects of being in the presence of, that already is communicating the Dharma to us. And it's very good just to spend time with these figures and just let our intuition work. It's like when we see a Buddhist figure, like the various paintings and things that we have in this room, the best way to look at it is to see it as a mirror. See each of these representations as a mirror. And it's a mirror which is not showing you the surface everyday you, it's showing you the depths of you. It's showing you your potential. It's showing you the qualities that you can unfold. So whenever you come upon a representation of a Buddhist figure that you haven't seen before, it's good to take an interest because it's all pointing to something about your potential awakening, what you can become, what you can become more of. So, yeah, if you come upon a Buddhist figure and you don't know anything about it, in a way the question to ask is, what would I be like if I looked like that? So, I mean, you come upon some strange figure with a thousand arms. So, and you think, well, you know, what? That looks really weird, a thousand arms. But if you then just feel your way into it and you feel, well, what about my potential is this same? Why would I want a thousand arms? And then you start to think, well, if I had a thousand arms, I could reach out to a thousand people. I could reach out into a thousand situations. I could really be of help to the world. I could really make a difference to things. So if we explore each of the figures in this way, we try not to take them literally. People get very literal-minded about Buddhas and Bodhisattvas very often, but they go way beyond the kind of literal mind. That's not the level of us that they're talking to. So it's much better if we just see if we can use our intuition, just sit with these figures and let them, as it were, kind of communicate to us non-verbally and just have a sense of what they have to do with us and our deep potential. So over today, we can just spend time with Akshobhya and just see what he would like to say to us. what the those symbols, what that colour, what that light nature of Akshobhya, what it has to say. And he's also smiling. He's smiling at us. He's smiling at us with great compassion. We can let that sink in too. So Akshobhya appears in the east of the mandala. And over the centuries, as Buddhism developed, as we saw, this whole mandala of five Buddhas appeared. And along with that, as time went on, more and more associations, a whole network of connections was made with these five Buddhas. So it's a bit like in your personal mandala, yes, you have what's most central, what's most important to you right at the centre, but then you find somewhere in the mandala all the different aspects of your life, your work and your relationships and so on, whatever it is. Similarly, over the centuries, Buddhism put the whole of life almost into the mandala. So basic human experiences all came to be linked with one or another of these Buddhas. So basic experiences like colour or where the sun is in the year or in the day, animals, elements, and so on. So all those became associated with the Buddha. So, for instance, Akshobhya, we've seen, is associated with deep blue. He's also associated with the east and with the dawn. He's associated with all the power and strength and immovable quality of the elephant. And he's associated with water, the element water. And then also, along with that, there were spiritual dharma associations. For instance, Akshobhya is associated with a bodhisattva called Vajrapani, a very powerful figure, wielding a diamond thunderbolt. And he's also associated with a female figure, a female consort called Lokshana, who is an embodiment of his wisdom, his mirror-like wisdom, as it's called. But all sorts of aspects of life were brought in. So naturally, Buddhism also brought in aspects of how it saw the world. So it sees the world in terms of us as human beings. There not being anything fixed about us. We're just a collection of processes. And these processes are called the five skandhas. So one of those skandhas is the skandha of form, what actually appears, the body, and so on. So that skandha of form is associated with Akshobhya. Spiritual qualities. So Akshobhya is particularly associated with wisdom. And even those qualities which we're trying to, issues which we're trying to resolve, negative emotions. So Akshobhya is also associated with hatred. So it's not exactly that you want hatred in your mandala, but you can draw the energy that is in hatred out of that negative expression and put that energy into the mandala, put it into the aspect of the mandala that's connected with Akshobhya. So in this way, the whole eastern quarter of the mandala becomes very rich. You have Akshobhya at its centre, you have Vajrapani and Lokshana, you have wisdom, but then you also have the east, the dawn, form, water, and so on. So this great network of connections eventually meant that all your everyday experience could be associated with the centre of the mandala. All your everyday experience could be associated, could be a reminder of awakening. So if you've been practicing, say you focus on Akshobhya, in a way just seeing dark blue, whether it's in a flower or what somebody's wearing, that will just be a reminder for you. It will call to mind the qualities of Akshobhya. Or just walking down from my room with a cup of water, there's a kind of security light just sort of outside my door, which sort of has a kind of little green light, and there's this beautiful kind of green reflection in my cup of water. And yeah, just because I've been thinking about Akshobhya, that just made me think about mirror-like wisdom. Something that appears but is not as it seems. So, yeah, in that way, just different aspects of life can become linked to enlightenment, can remind us of what it is we're trying to do with our lives. So, now I want to explore a couple of central themes connected with Akshobhya. In one talk, I can't begin to do him justice. So we're going to pick up a couple of points and explore them. If you want to know more about the different Buddhas or you want background reading, I'm going to take my life in my hands and actually recommend one of my books. It's called A Guide to the Buddhas. It's the first part of what was called Meeting the Buddhas, which I wrote 20 years ago now. But rereading it, it still seems reasonably reliable. So, yeah, it would be, if you just want something to read, just for a fuller picture of these figures than we can give you just in talks like this, that would be a good place to go, I think. So, now I want to look at this earth-touching mudra, and also, I said yesterday that the different Buddhas were emanations or derived from Shakyamuni Buddha. So let's explore that a little bit. So it seems to me that one of the ways in which this form of Akshobhya came about was through people reflecting on the Buddha, and particularly, of course, reflecting a lot on the Buddha's enlightenment. If we want to be enlightened ourselves, well then, it's good to really get to know what happened, that story, the way in which enlightenment and how the Buddha attained it is represented in the texts. So, in some of the accounts of the Buddha's life, it's as if they try to take you inside the mind of the Buddha, because enlightenment itself, viewed from outside, well, it's not much of a spectator sport, really. You know, if you were sitting by the Naranjara, sweating in the heat of, you know, April, May time in India, and there was this very emaciated figure under a tree, not moving for a long time, you would have sweated some more and got very bored and probably gone away. But if you'd hung around, you would eventually have maybe seen the dawn break, and maybe this figure open his eyes and look at the morning star and look radiantly happy and get up and walk up and down a bit, but that would have been it. So, in order to kind of help us along, some of the sort of realized early Buddhists, they sort of gave us a sense of more of what was going on inside the mind of the Buddha. And one of the ways in which they try to describe what's going on is the Buddha having encounters with Mara. Mara is the embodiment of everything which holds you back. He's the embodiment of everything which trips you up, everything which pulls you towards the mundane, the unsatisfying, everything which keeps you suffering, keeps you getting fooled again and again. So the particular incident which seems to relate to Akshobhya is that there's the Buddha, he's come to this spot which is represented as the Vajra seat. The Vajra is the diamond. It's what's unshakable, it's what's immutable, unchangeable. So it's as if the Buddha is represented as coming to a sort of central place in himself, the place from which he can't be pulled by craving or pushed by aversion, a place which is beyond ignorance. So he's represented in the sort of mythic version of the story as coming to this diamond seat, which is the place where all Buddhas have gained enlightenment. And we don't have to take that as some sort of historical statement. It's just saying that there is only one way to be in order to gain enlightenment. There's only one way to experience, and that's beyond craving and aversion and ignorance. It's beyond dualistic separating out into me here and the world out there. So the Buddha sits down on the Vajra seat, which symbolically and archetypally is a tremendous act, it's a tremendous statement to actually kind of dare to sit on that seat. And Mara tries different things to dislodge the Buddha, to prevent him from gaining enlightenment. And after he's tried one or two things, he tries just praying on any lingering doubt that's left in the Buddha's mind. So he says to him, "You're seated on the seat where all the Buddhas of old have sat. Who are you to sit there? Who do you think you are? By what right do you sit on that seat?" And the Buddha says, "Well, I sit here because I'm ready to sit here. I've practiced over long, long periods of time, and I've practiced all the perfections, generosity, ethical action, and so on. I'm ready to sit on this seat." But Mara says, "You may say that, but who's your witness?" And at that point, the Buddha doesn't argue with Mara, he doesn't debate with Mara. He just touches the earth. Actually, in some versions, before he touches the earth, he touches various points on his body. And then he touches the earth. And in response to that gesture, that mudra, as it's called, up from the earth appears the goddess of the earth. And she says, "Yes, I've seen in practice. It's true what he says. He is speaking the truth. He has developed a great heap of merit from good actions over endless time. So he sits on that seat by right." And we can take all that as internal drama. We don't have to take it as some kind of naive folk tale. It's about what's happening in the Buddha's mind. There is part of him that has pursued the path to awakening, and it's brought him to this point where he can feel he's on the verge of a complete breakthrough. But then there's also this little voice going, "Oh, who are you? What's special about you? Why you?" It's a little kind of self-doubt, a little kind of questioning. In a way, it's not just self-doubt. It's still a little voice of the ego project, still in there. It's still, yeah, it's still trying to take you into that world. Actually, we all have the potential to sit on that seat. It's just that we prevent ourselves from doing it by getting lost in a whole story about ourselves and what goes on. So it's like the last vestiges of that story just appearing in the Buddha's mind. And to kind of answer back and, you know, sort of try to explain and, well, this and that and I did that, that doesn't do it. That would take the Buddha out of his present experience. So rather than go out of the present experience, the Buddha goes deeply into the present experience. It's like he goes deeply into his immediate experience, and he, by touching the earth, and out of that, again, we don't have to take the earth goddess, you know, sort of giving her testimony, sort of literally. It's more like enlightenment comes out of direct experience. Most of the time, we are living in a story. Yeah. Human beings, we're storytelling animals. And we are constantly telling ourselves the story of me and how it's going. How's my life going? You know, at the moment it's difficult because, you know, I'm hard up, or I've lost my job, or, you know, or it's going really well, I've got a new relationship, this has just happened. All the time, we're just telling ourselves the story of me. And however good that story gets, it's never going to take us to where we want to go. It's still going to be a story. So this earth-touching gesture and this whole incident with the Buddha with Mara, which sort of forms into Akshobhya, is about the fact that for us to develop on the path, we need to be coming closer and closer and closer to our direct experience rather than all our stories about it. If you want a good kind of question to ask in meditation or outside it, it's always a good question to ask, well, what is my actual experience now rather than my ideas about it? It's like when we first start practicing meditation and we practice the mindfulness of breathing, very often, sometimes the first time you do it, it goes very well because you just sit down, you don't know what to expect, and somebody says, well, just do this, and so you just do it, and it's good. The second time you sit down, you're telling yourself a story about what happened the first time, and so you have expectations, so it's more difficult. But as you go into the mindfulness of breathing, you find firstly there are lots of thought chains, which may or may not even be about the meditation, leading you here and there. And also you find, I certainly found to start with, that actually I wasn't experiencing the breath. I was experiencing an idea of the breath, and that was subtly different. And it took time to sort of really work into getting to just the direct, simple experience of breathing in and breathing out without any sort of subtle, even subtle ideas and assumptions about it. So, Mara's challenge to the Buddha is all about confidence, and it's about doubt and confidence. And in a way, Buddhism distinguishes between two kinds of doubt. There's the very reasonable questions that we all have as we're practicing, and they're good. They're really good things. Buddhism and Buddhist teachers have never minded people having questions, because one way of looking at the whole Dharma is that it's an inquiry. It's an inquiry into life and what it is. The whole mystery of being a human being. One way in which you can see a Sangha is as a community of inquirers. A community of people who are exploring life together. Exploring how to live it in fulfilling ways. Exploring whether the Dharma is true, and if so, how. And how to apply it to ourselves. And then just sharing what we find, sharing what works, sharing what doesn't work. Coming up against questions, discussing those with other people. That's part of the lifeblood of a Sangha, is that that's going on. So on a retreat like this, you have questions. And that's a good thing. But then there's another level of doubt, which is not being prepared to come to conclusions about things, which is a hindrance. It's about hopes and fears about what we might find if we were to really put ourselves into the practice. And it's quite easy to get into a situation where you have that kind of uneasy, I don't really want to do this unless I'm sure it's going to work, sort of feeling. And because of that, you don't really put yourself into the practice, and so it doesn't work. And so you get into this kind of negative, sort of blocked way of being. So we need to find ways out of that. We need to find ways. And one of the ways out of that is by actually finding what are the genuine questions and answering them and resolving it. But in all of us, there's the part that wants to practice the Dharma and the part that doesn't, so there's tension in there. And then there is just that kind of wavering, that not really wanting to settle on the Dharma in a certain kind of way. It's like, actually, most of us in this room, we've probably heard enough Dharma already. I've certainly heard enough Dharma, for the last, 40 years. It's been enlightened about sort of 57 times over. It's not that I don't know enough to be enlightened. It's that something in me has sort of wavered and vacillated, has never quite settled on just really putting myself into it 100% fully and completely. If I'd done that, you'd be getting a much better talk. And it's difficult too, because the society around us isn't reinforcing very often, the decision to really go with the Dharma. We're surrounded by all kinds of different views and opinions about how to live life and what's it's about and what's the best way to do things. There's a billion-pound industry all out there, trying to sell us. Well, they're trying to sell us products and services, but along with that, they're selling us a vision of how to live. They're selling us a vision of what you need in order to be a fulfilled human being. And it's very good to keep sort of listening, not just to the offers to sell you something or provide something for you, but to also listen to the assumptions behind those offers. What view of life are you being sold? What view of how to be a happy human being are you being offered when you're being offered some kind of consumer goodie? So, given that we're in the middle of a society which is bombarding us with other views of how to be happy, which is bombarding us with all kinds of anxieties and fears, often via the media in different ways, how are we going to settle on the Dharma, given that we have our own mixed responses to it anyway? So, in other words, where do we get our confidence from? And I'll just suggest a few possibilities. Obviously, this is reading and reflecting on the Dharma itself. The more that you do that, the clearer you get. That does dispel doubt. Also, just reading the life stories and experiences of people who have really practiced, whether it's from the past, sort of Milarepa or Jui, whoever it might be, or much more present figures, just reading about people who went for it, people who really put themselves on the line and practiced deeply, and just seeing how fulfilled they were, just seeing who they ended up being. I can find that does encourage me to actually get on and practice. Then also just being around people who have confidence in the Dharma. Confidence in the Dharma is infectious. It's always good to be in regular contact with people who have more experience than you do. As you'll know, I went on this long retreat for over 3 years recently. And I could have just gone away by myself. I've been practicing a long time. I would have made reasonably good use of it. But I actually wanted still to be in a situation where I could have some mentoring and guidance. Because I just knew that I'd make more effective use of that time. And some of our doubts arise from the fact that we are practicing sincerely, but with blind spots. And we're practicing as best we can from within the worldview that we've got and our understanding of ourselves that we've got and our understanding of the Dharma that we've got. But all of that is a bit limited and one-sided. So I found, even after having been practicing for quite a long time, that having somebody that I met with from time to time on my retreat, they would point to things about my meditation which were just a bit off, that I couldn't see. I just kind of took it for granted that how I practiced was how you should practice. And they could just come along and say, no, actually, you could practice a bit differently here. I found that very helpful. And then even just being around somebody who is really confident in the Dharma is fantastic, because it's one thing to have people talk to you about the Dharma who have read and practiced to some extent, but if you meet somebody who actually really embodies it more deeply, say like for me, knowing Sangharakshita over all these years, it's done a tremendous amount for my confidence in the Dharma, just watching somebody who clearly has some real insight into it and who clearly is committed to the Bodhisattva ideal and for whom that has been a fantastic way to live. Somebody who's made a huge difference to the lives of thousands of people just by really, really putting themselves into it. That encourages me to really devote more of my energy to things. And then another way out of this kind of half-practicing that is very easy to get into. In the Sevenfold Puja we say, wholeheartedly also I take my refuge. I sometimes feel I should be saying half-heartedly also I take my refuge, because, am I really doing it? No, I'm not. So I'm not giving myself a hard time. I'm just aware that there's much more that could be done. One other way that we can work with this is just to take some aspect of the Dharma that you think might be beneficial for you, but you're not sure. And rather than sort of half do it, just give yourself a time period 3 months or 6 months, whatever it might be, in which you really do it. You do it wholeheartedly over that period of time, and then you review it. That's very much sort of in the spirit of the Dharma. The Dharma is called ekipassikō. It's a sort of come and see thing. It's a sort of come and try it out thing. So, yeah, you take a bit of Dharma, and ideally in consultation with a Kalyana Mitra, so that you've got a sense that you are actually practicing in the right way, so that you don't practice it in the wrong way and then decide that it doesn't work. So in consultation with somebody, you take it on for a period of time and just really do it. You know? So if you haven't had much of a regular meditation practice, okay, well you say, okay, for this period of time, I'm just going to do it. And I'm going to really put myself into it. And then I'll review it and see, well, was that a good use of my time? Was it worth it? Or you take up one of the precepts and you really have a go for a period of time, whatever it might be. So it's quite sort of scientific in a way. You get to see, well, if you really make a good effort of it, you know, has it made a difference? And then the other way of developing confidence is just by noticing and appreciating where there are signs of growth in yourself. It's like we may not have an earth goddess who will appear to say, yes, endless stocks of merit this person has accumulated. Although actually we never know. Actually we've obviously done some things right just to come into contact with the Dharma, just to be here. And Sangharakshita says, well, actually you never know, you may just be an advanced bodhisattva having an off life. But yeah, whatever positive signs you find in yourself, you know, whatever little signs of growth, yeah, just appreciate those. And in a sangha we can all do that for one another, and that really, that aids that confidence and breaks out of that sense of doubt. Right, okay. So Akshobhya touches the earth of direct experience. And another way of looking at this is that he's just very much in the present moment. And he's associated with this skanda of form. And with integration, his seed syllable is hung. And hung is about integration. It's about bringing the Dharma, bringing reality into manifestation. It's about bringing the Dharma into your heart. So one aspect of practice associated with Akshobhya is bringing awareness into the body, bringing awareness into a sense of rootedness, of connectedness with the earth. And that's a very basic practice for integration. It's a very good place always to start in meditation. You call up the earth goddess by feeling your connection with the earth. You make that connection with the ground. You bring yourself into a sense of embodiment as much as you can. I saw somebody a few days ago who told me this story, which I was a bit taken aback by. This person was very keen on dance and movement. And they'd said to an experienced practitioner that they saw that as a kind of meditation. And this practitioner had said, no, that's not meditation. And, well, it depends, you know, you can use the word meditation in lots of different ways. So we need, you know, it's not a question of is it or isn't it, it's a question of what you mean by meditation. You know, clearly, mindfulness of the body is a beneficial thing, and being embodied is a beneficial thing. But this person had then gone on to say, meditation happens from the neck up. Now, maybe my friend misunderstood, and maybe it's misquoted, but I think most meditation actually happens from the neck down. A lot of meditation is about drawing energy out of the kind of the control tower up in your head from which you kind of view life, and into direct experience, becoming more alive in your experience. And part of that is becoming more alive and grounded and embodied. Meditation also happens in your heart center a lot of the time, which is situated below the neck. So, yeah, part of integration is just becoming more embodied. Clearly, integration, there are lots of different aspects to it. I haven't time to go into them all now. Ethical practice is a very good way of discovering how to become more integrated. But yes, mindfulness of the body, becoming more grounded, is also gives you a basis for, in a way, your whole spiritual practice. Because yes, the body is always now. The body is always the present moment. And the whole story that we tell ourselves about ourselves, the whole way in which we keep the ego project going, needs a past and a future. The whole thing about me is that I've always been like this, or this has happened to me in the past, and all that has led to how I am now. And then there are all my concerns about, what will happen to me, during the rest of the retreat, and then after that, and in 2013, and so on. In that way, I keep a sense of me going. A story with, a one-second episode, and no past and no future episodes, is no story at all. It just doesn't work. So, a very good way in which to be more integrated, a very good way in which to come more into a deeper awareness is just to really focus on present moment practice, just to notice in meditation out of it how much of the time you're back in the past, reliving those past triumphs and feeling cross about what happened 10 years ago. Or you're off in the future with hopes and fears about what's going to happen. Because it's really important to recognise that the past and the future don't exist now. All that exists now is this. Right this moment, all we have is one another. Yeah. Whatever other experiences we may have had, they are not here. And it's quite good to make that more real and vivid and present to ourselves. Apart from anything else, it makes us more alive in the present. Very often we're sort of, our awareness is kind of rather diffusedly, partly a bit sort of around in the past and the future, and not very with what's happening right now. So because of that, we're not very alive in what happens now. Whereas people who are deeply practicing, you find that they are really in the present. I'm just remembering one or two anecdotes of people telling me they met Dado Rinpoche, one of Bhante's teachers, before he died. And one of the things which they quite often would say was, it felt like I was the only person there. They just were, for that time, I felt like they were just totally with me. And that was partly because somebody like Dado Rinpoche would be, because he wouldn't have a sense of being separate from the person. But also, Dado Rinpoche was just really living his life in the present. So when you came to see him, you were his whole world for that time. Of course, if you had all his attention, he was really just there with you. When we do puja, I often try to get a sense of you know, the Buddha being present. And sometimes that doesn't work. But if it doesn't work, I realize it's because I'm not present. I'm off in the past, off in the future. I'm not really in the situation. So if we just focus a little bit more on the fact that all we have is now, apart from anything else, the people that we're with, they become a little bit more valuable. That sense of, well, you know, I don't really want to be talking to them because I want to be talking to somebody else in the future. That somebody else in the future isn't here now. The person that you're with is the person that you're with. That's, they are the world right this moment. It's that old Crosby, Stills and Nash thing. If you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. Because they are the only one you're with. So part of Akshobhya's message is, yeah, being in the body, being in the present, being in the now, all that brings us more to life. It takes energy out of the thinking and the stories. Yes, occasionally we need to tell ourselves stories, yeah? If you've got to book a train ticket, you need to tell yourself the story about you going somewhere else. But then you can just put it down. Yeah. The trouble is that the stories take over. We just become identified with a story, and that causes us to feel half dead and constantly stirred up. Okay. So I've covered quite a few areas and still left quite a few areas to cover for those of you who are here next week for Akshobhya. Hopefully there are some things that you can explore in discussion groups. There are some quite practical things about our own lives that we could maybe explore if you feel like you can go there. You can look at what your versions are of Mara's question. How does Mara trip you up? Where are your doubts and uncertainties about the Dharma and applying it to your life? And where are the genuine questions? And where is there just that sense of, well, I could, but I'm not, the sort of emotional resistance which prevents you from coming to a conclusion? Also, yes, in what areas do you feel you're really being affected or carried along by assumptions and views that are just current in society? Yeah, as I said, we get bombarded. Yeah, the media isn't just giving us news and information. Again, if you feel the whole emotional tone and the way things are put, you're being offered a view of life. Advertising is offering us a view of life. So some of the time it's water off a duck's back, but in some other ways we're affected by that. So where is that? And could we do anything about it? How could we set up conditions to support us and to support our confidence in our practice? It's like we come somewhere here and our confidence tends to grow because we're in the conditions where that confidence is supported. So how could we build on that as we go on to our life, the rest of our life? Then we can look at, you know, how embodied is our practice? Are we managing to move more into the present moment? Has our practice helped us to do those things? And if not, is there some way in which we could explore that further? And also, we can just reflect on this dark blue figure of Akshobhya, this imperturbable Buddha, and just see what that figure conveys to you about spiritual practice. What does the fact that we can meet a Buddha like Akshobhya, what does that say about our potential as a human being? And how could we unfold it more during these days and in the time to come?